hamster with a blunt penknife would do it quicker.
Welcome back to Hamster with a Blunt Penknife, the Doctor Who commentary podcast. I am having a glorious evening today with my new friend, Mr. Dan Pin. Hello, Dan. How are you doing?
Hello. I'm loving it. I'm really good.
We're talking Sylvester McCoy, baby.
Oh, yeah.
So we are now two episodes into Paradise Tower. So obviously, I'm going to ask you, this is a true test as to whether you do listen to Hamster with Blunt Penknife or not. If you could please summarise the entire plot to date. Off you go.
So, the Doctor and Mal were planning a trip because Mal was very keen to go swimming. So there was this, the whole reason they're there is to go to this swimming pool that is at the top of this tower block. When they get there, it's looking rather shabby and run down. We find that there are rival girl gangs running wild throughout the towers. But people are disappearing. And the rumour is that it's the clean robots are bumping people off. As we explore further, we're introduced to the caretakers that are run by a rather Jobsworth chief caretaker, and they live by a rule book. And some of them die by it as well later on. The Doctor, you know, is captured by them. He then escapes from them. He's then captured again by the Kangs, and he builds up a friendship with those guys. Then, because the Doctor and Mal have been separated, she comes into contact with a couple of residents or resis, who seem very sweet and innocent and very nice, just like, you know, your dear old grandma kind of, you know, that lives down the road. then she's rather violently introduced to Pex, who bursts through their door. And Mal continues on her quest to find the pool at the top, with Pex tagging along. Later on, she finds out that Pex is basically a bit of a coward, and he had run away from a war that most of the Paradise Towers residents were sent to, other than those that were too old or too young. And then she finds herself in the home of the Rezis again. But this time, as we found out with that cliffhanger, they have got ulterior motives than just feeding her up with tea and cookies. And that is basically, they want her for lunch.
That sounds like an amazing Doctor Who story.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy as fuck, isn't it?
Oh, man. Yeah. I mean, think about it. On paper, that sounds, again, it sounds bad.
I don't think it sounds bad at all. I just think it sounds quirky.
Yeah.
Eccentric, shall we say.
I mean, that's the thing, is it's one of those stories that is quite unique, isn't it? Yes. You know, even when you put it into context with things that we've seen in New Who, you know, that Russell and Moffat and Chibbers have done, it still stands out as being sort of in a category of one, really, doesn't it? There's not much that's like it.
What baffles me is, yeah, how the two things, the society like this, all in one contained setting, has never really been done before. And the building that tries to kill you, which just seems so custom made for Doctor Who, because it's kind of cheap, you know, that's never been done before either. So they're sort of ticking two boxes as they go.
And it begs the question, and I think this is, we've kind of alluded to this, that there's many a problem with some of the plot, and it gives you like, well, that doesn't make sense. It's like, so they're in this tower block. Does that mean there are other tower blocks as well on this planet?
Because, well, we open with a shot of several tower blocks,
yeah,
don't we?
Yeah. And I know obviously the problem with this one is that in the basement there's something unpleasant. I don't want to ruin that for anyone.
Did they ever explain why they can't just go out through the front doors?
Exactly. You know, it's
We
almost like
never cover that, do we?
they're locked in this tower block, you know, never to feel fresh air on their face. It's
Maybe there should be a line, you know, a terroristic line again of like, I don't know, the atmosphere outside the towers is poisonous because our bomb was dropped during the war or something like that, you know?
Yeah, like the leisure hive, you know, going outside,
Yeah.
it's not good for you. Yeah.
But you know, I think this is one of those times where the society has presented the characters within and the situations are so fun to watch. I don't mind that there are logical inconsistencies and things that they haven't quite tied up.
It, no, I mean, it's the nature of Doctor Who, isn't it? There are very few stories where there aren't plot holes in it that you could drive a bus through. You know, if you pick it apart, you can find them.
If anyone could find the story out there, let Dan and I know in the tweets when this goes out,
Yes,
all right? Because I don't think there is one.
I stand to be corrected on that because it may well exist, but
Someone's going to throw Curse of Fenric at us, but trust me, I've got a list of plot holes for that one.
okay. I'll let you defend that. Yeah, but that's the thing, isn't it? You know, when the story that you're presented with is so enjoyable from the other aspects, you can look beyond that. And I think as Doctor Who fans, we're very good at doing that. You know, because you could find, you know, those ones that are held up as classics, you know, Genesis of Daleks, Caves of Androzani, you know, these ones that, you know, we're kind of these are the pinnacles of classic Doctor Who. You can find them in there if you look, you know. I
Genesis
mean,
has got a bloody great clams in it. I mean, what was Davros trying to do? The biggest clam chowder you've ever seen.
don't know. And then,
So
you know, and the magma beast in there, I mean, bloody hell, that's dreadful, isn't
he
it?
keeps it in the dark, in the mist for a
You
reason,
know,
doesn't he?
as much as he can.
But I think as well, it's always worth remembering that Doctor Who was supposed to be seen an episode at a time. Once a week, 25 minutes once a week. That's not a lot of time. And I don't think a lot of people sort of looked at stories as a whole. You couldn't, because you were watching it over a month.
Yeah. And also, back in the day, it was a one shot. You saw it once, and that was it, you know, until the invent of video.
Well, we're kind of in the video age, I think, at this point, aren't we? In
Yeah.
87.
I mean, I know my family, we didn't get one until the 90s,
I
so
think we had one late 80s. Scotch tapes were our tape of choice. And if you'd had a long play tape, you could get three 4-part Doctor Who stories on it.
oh really?
I'm so old, Dan, honestly.
No, because I remember our first one was a top loader, the bit that you, because normally
Oh, they are the best.
it just like whoop, it came out the
And
top of it.
it sort of goes.
Yeah, so but I did, because I think, like, when we had that, I was because it was weird, we didn't have a video for ages, but mum and dad were we I remember having Sky TV, so I had the UK Go repeats, and I must have been about 14, 15 when I had that. So that, you know, that was my way of kind of plugging a lot of those gaps, because for all of us, it felt quite a slow process, wasn't it, for the VHSs to all be kind of
Oh,
released. It
it felt
was,
like it took forever, but then when it was all over, I was like, oh no.
oh yeah, I
What were you
mean.
saying then when they were going off to the other town? Can you please bring me back some long play tapes? How things have changed.
Yeah, but I look back rather fondly on those Sunday mornings on UK Go.
Oh, I
We
loved
had
them.
what was it, Survivors, Blake Seven, and then you had a Doctor Who story at the end. It was ace.
I mean, I've told this story a million times, so I won't labour the point. But I'd go out to Revenge in Brighton of a Saturday night, have an incredible lay, come home. I would wake up in some basement flat in Brighton. I didn't know where I was. Sort of go out into the light, find a coffee and a croissant, get the first train home, stick on UK Gold, and there we were, Invasion of the Dinosaurs or something fabulous like that, you know. God, what a life. the mid '90s.
I can as the 90s went on, I can remember watching many of those mornings very, very hungover on a Sunday.
Yeah,
Oh.
sometimes that helped, you know. Other times, like the Sea Devils, I was like, I can't stand that noise in my mind.
Yeah. Oh man. Yeah. Yeah.
Actually, maybe even Paradise Towers would be a bit much for that funky music. Oh, it's worth talking about Kevin McCulloch. Well, I'll tell you what, should we go into three?
Yeah. Let's do it.
Because there's still a ton, so we haven't even spoken about the director yet. Well, we can count us in.
Okay. I'll do that. 3, 2, 1, go.
What do you think about Nicholas Mallet then?
Well, I like all of the stories that he directed.
So you like Mysterious Planet?
Yeah. I was having this conversation with Luke at the because and Dave Rennie. Yeah, because Luke hates Mysterious Planet. He says it's just boring. Whereas for me, it's my favorite Colin Baker story. Yeah, I just love so much about it.
That is
And I
an
think
unusual but wonderful opinion. Go on.
yeah, I think part of it is nostalgia because, like I was telling the lads, both me and Dave were reminiscing about that lovely TARDIS tin with Trial of a Time Lord in it that came out in 93. And I remember that Christmas, for whatever reason, my mum said I could have one present. I mean, which is daft because I was like 14, 15. So you think I could contain myself for one more day. But she goes, you can have one present Christmas Eve.
Oh,
So I
and
go,
you took the creme de la creme, did
yeah,
you?
I took that TARDIS tin. And yeah, I remember watching the first time I watched Mysterious Planet was
Christmas
Christmas Eve,
Eve. Oh
1990.
my gosh. It's great when you can pin it to a day.
Yeah, and I just loved it. I hadn't got at that point. I think we only had had was it we'd had Twin Dilemma and Vengeance on Varos. I think those were the only Colin Baker releases on VHS at that point, I believe. And I didn't have Twin Dilemma because it was a wasn't it a Woolworths exclusive or something, I
That's
believe.
right. Yeah.
I didn't get that one. So, but I was like, wow, this is amazing. This and I love a visual, and that I know people don't like his costume, but don't Colin and Nicola look great walking through that forest
Oh,
at the
that's
beginning?
great.
It's all the mist,
Arm in arm as well.
and this little blob of color that just coming towards us, and it gradually comes in, and it's Colin and Nicola. Yeah, and Glitz and Dibber, what a great
Oh,
for
Dibber, don't
me,
get me started, Dan, all
yeah,
right?
for me they are they're one of Robert Holmes's best double acts, I feel, but I know a lot of people wouldn't agree with that because it's not
Isn't he
good.
talking about his therapist? And he
Yeah.
goes, a deep-seated maladjusted, he said. Mind you, I had just attempted to kill him. Oh, that's great.
Was it Dibber going, "Oh, that sounds like an insult, that doesn't it?" Just
Don't think about it too hard, Dibber. You give yourself a hernia. Oh, hang on a second. Someone's just gone down that shaft. Poor
yeah.
old Tabby.
And this is the bit with the knife. She's coming at her with a knife.
This is really quite scary, I think, when she's like, what a naughty little girl we are. There's something very sinister about
Yeah.
that. And a bit real world. And I think it is.
Here he comes.
Oh God.
And what I love about it, though, is it takes a few seconds for him to realize that there is actually something going on for once, rather than him just scaring old ladies.
And unfortunately, you can see the string that is attached to the knife where they've pulled the knife away from the wall and then reversed it. Unfortunately. But never mind, you know, these
Never.
were primitive times.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, sorry, back to Nick Mallet.
Yeah. So I think he I've like I say, I mean I'm I mean, from a directorial point of view, I don't really go into those kind of things too deep, but I know that all three of those stories that he did are ones that I hold quite highly, and I enjoy all three of them. I mean, I suppose in perceived fan wisdom, the only one that's perceived as a classic is Curse, isn't it? And there's some there's some wonderful bits in that. I love the all those kind of like underwater shots of
Oh,
the
that was
Russians coming around
JNT.
again.
JNT
Oh, was that
directed those
Dane? Oh,
bits.
right. Okay. Oh, wow. Oh, me. Yeah.
So one bit of direction I'm highlighting was by somebody else. No, of course, sorry.
Yeah. Oh, right. Okay. But again, I mean, I don't know if you've ever had the pleasure of going to Lulworth Cove and Durdledore.
No, not yet.
Oh, it's beautiful. I've done it a couple of times now, and it's just fantastic because it still looks as it did in Curse of Fenric.
Where they shot Power of the Doctor at the end. Is that the
Yes.
same place? Yeah.
The sort of arch thing, that's Durdledore, yeah. Down in Dorset.
I'll say one thing I will say for Nick Mallet is I think he's got three brilliant casts in all of his story. That the acting on display is out of this world. I think he is a very flawed director. I think he gets the lightness of touch in Mysterious Planet right,
Okay.
but the action is a bit awkward. Especially that bit where Colin's tied up to that machine going through the woods, it's all a bit pony. I think in this, he's directing well within the studio, but tonally, I don't think he's quite got it right.
No, because I mean, you've said it yourself tonight a couple of times that the story that he seems to be telling, it feels like a different one to what Stephen Wyatt wanted to tell. I think those really successful stories, it feels like it's a coming again together of everything. The director, the script writer, the script editor, the producer, the special effects and all that sort of thing. When they come together and work together as a team, you've got magic there. But it does feel like there's a little bit of a disconnect here.
It's a funny script that Stephen White has written, packed full of funny lines. But the best way to deliver that, I think, in Doctor Who is play it straight and let the comedy come out of it. Whereas I feel like this is played as a comedy a lot of the time, which does make it really enjoyable to watch, but perhaps not as disturbing as it might have been. Whereas, oh, don't come at me with knives. I actually think Curse of Fenric is his weakest direction. I don't think he shoots very well on location. I don't think he frames shots very well. I don't think it's edited very well. I think there is some great stuff in there, but I think it does look a bit awkward at times.
I think that's the thing, though, with Fenric, because there was so much material, like you say, enough to fill another episode. It could have gone to five. I guess because of the way that they had to be so brutal with the edit, I guess some of it gets,
We're
possibly
not
gets.
seeing his vision, are we?
No,
Like,
exactly.
but I accept that as a minority view, and because Fenric is a much treasured story by everyone but me, so I'll shut up. But I do think he always produces something very watchable.
Like I say, the three stories that he did, I love all three of those.
You said earlier about the set and how big it feels. Do you think it's because not only because they've done the two levels and they saw it is a big set, but because there's so many walkways to other directions, it just feels like this like maze.
Yeah, I mean, I should imagine it's not as big as it looks, but the set design has done an absolutely superb job in kind of being clever with what little they've got. I think, because like you say, you've got all these walkways, but you've got corridors coming off of it. So it's one of those things where it feels like you're always looking at a new corridor, a corridor that they haven't been down before. They probably have, but they've dressed it. And shot it from angles where you get that kind of like this is a bit of Paradise Towers we haven't explored yet,
You said it there, shot it. So fair play to Malik, because he has to shoot it at different angles and make it feel vast. It's a bit like what Fiona Cumming does in the TARDIS in Castrovalva. Clearly, she's got a tiny corridor to shoot in, and she makes it feel like a labyrinth.
That's just the work of a clever...
Oh, what do you think about this bit here? Where it starts off, he's in the chair being interrogated by the chief caretaker. And by the end of the scene, the chief caretaker's in the chair being interrogated by the doctor.
Yeah, it is brilliant. And you know, that feels like another classic Seventh Doctor moment, isn't it? Where he's able to outthink and out-talk his And like you say, because the Richard Brier's performance of this is so large, McCoy's really quite contained, quite small, and it does play to his strengths as an actor. He does those bits so well.
I always think when he underplays, he's brilliant. Ghostlight, Burnt Toast, Bus Stations, it's just brilliant. Go listen to him in Master, The Big Finish Story, where he's underplaying so much of that. Oh my God, he just goes to the chief caretaker. He goes, I don't know why you would do that, but then I'm not a power crazed psychopath. He's great. Oh, this is that line from Clive Merrison about two of the Ulsters have gone down the waste disposal unit. I mean, it is funny, this.
Yeah. And again, they at this point, they feel like a brilliant double act, the deputy and the chief. They work really well together.
It's why when in episode 4, he's behaving like he's constipated, you know, walking around with that strange walk. He's like, when the chief caretaker clearly is not the chief caretaker. He jumps over the cleaner robot to get out of the room.
He legs it, yeah.
I want no more funny business with the rule book this time, Dan. Okay.
Okay. I love that. I don't know if he's probably done more now, but his way of referring to the doctor is sunbeam like that. You know, I love that bit.
Doesn't he go at one point? There'll be something in here without a deal with it.
Yeah.
Oh, this bit is total panto, where she goes, oh, we'll be all right as long as the lights don't go out. And then the lights go out. It's like, fucking hell, who are we aiming this at?
I mean, this must have been a really hard scene to act, because
are you talking about the whole story here, or just that scene?
No. Just well, there are other bits, but that lift bit, because how do you make something quite mundane sinister and threatening? It's like, I mean, I don't know whether they do it successfully or not.
If you're Bonnie Langford, you take it up to 11.
But I
do love the bit where the lift starts free falling. That's when it was really doing that, the building's trying to kill us stuff, you know. And then, oh, I fucking love the bits in the pool with that robot. When I was a kid, oh, man, I used to be in my bath. I was like, you're right, yeah. I'm just playing Mel.
No, it's another brilliant piece of design as well, I think. It feels like it's, you know, again, it feels like something they've actually spent some money on. They haven't, you know, it doesn't feel like they've skimped on that, even though it's only, what is it, in the story for about like 5 minutes at tops, you know.
They do like POV shots from his office, don't they, and stuff.
The pixelation.
With Mel there with a gun. Oh, I love this bit. I'll tell you why. It's because you've got Earth from Keeping Up Appearances and him from The Good Life. So it's like a sitcom convention. And he bribes her, doesn't he? You keep your mouth shut, I'll give you a bigger apartment, you know, about their deaths. And it makes it feel like this is a bigger world with sort of relationships between people and rules being broken. But it's not, doesn't feature the regulars at all.
No. I mean, that's. I think that's the lovely bit about this, that there is wonderful world building in it, isn't it? You know, it's not necessarily revolving around the Doctor and Mal. You know, they're sort of weaved throughout this world, and they're trying to piece it together so that they can sort it. But you know, we are looking in on these lives of these various
It feels, do you know what? It feels like an established setting before the Doctor and Mel arrive. And it feels like a setting that will go on after the Doctor and Mel have left. Oh, I'm telling you now, not every Doctor Who story does that. A lot of Doctor Who stories feel like they are custom made for the Doctor to appear in, sort everything out, and then go. And that's all they exist for, you know? I'm talking, what, Monster Repelodon, Time Lash, that sort of story.
Did you I don't know if you're into comics, but did you ever read the is it Obverse comics, Cutaway Comics? They did a Paradise Towers four-parter.
Haven't read it, but one of my contributors to the book club is Ian Winston, who works for Cutaway Comics and does writing for them and play audio plays and things like that. And he's told me a lot about it. They've also done Happiness Patrol as well. I can't wait to see. That's Adrian Salmon drawing that. Well, have you got that one then? The Paradise Hours one?
I have, yeah. I've got the first three parts. I haven't got the fourth one. I never got. I don't know why I never got around to buying it, but I will do it at some point. But yeah, I mean, it was really good, and it also kind of showed. I feel that point of view of you're seeing Paradise Towers after the Doctor's been and gone, you know, and how it, although he's caused a revolution and sorted this, but there's still issues, you know. It's not the magic wand. This is now perfect society kind of thing.
Some really great point, because there's a couple of Doctor Who stories where I'm like, I would really like to see, because the Doctor basically swans in, changes the entire planet. I'm thinking like the Sunmakers, where he just goes off at the end and leaves the rebels. Bye, you know, and they just toss someone off a building. Or Avengers on Varos, these are horrible people. He's overthrown, you know, the evil part of the government and just left the rest and completely. And okay, what the hell happened next?
It's not a basis for a stable government, is it?
So what happened in Paradise Towers? Do you remember?
No,
Okay.
no.
Well, I'll tell you what, before we do our next hamster commentary, that's if I haven't scared you off, then
No.
have a read and you can fill us in.
Yeah, I'll get the fourth part so I can tell the whole story.
I like all of this, the disc that shows the backstory of Paradise Towers being created and how it was supposed to look and all of that, because they really are seeding this idea that the person behind this incredible building is in fact the evil mastermind that is trying to murder everybody. Do you think we've made the connection at this point that that thing in the basement, which really scared me as a kid, that voice, that hungry.
And all the
Have we made
smoke.
the connection that that's Karagnon, or do we have to be told?
I mean, that's a. I mean, I don't know if I did as a child.
I don't think I did. Generally, I had to be
I'm pretty
told.
sure. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was sort of like one of those. Oh, yeah, I see. When it was kind of fully explained.
What are you doing there, robotic cleaner number 479?
I mean, look at the shadows and the highlights.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't see that very often in 90s.
This is what Warriors of the Deep should have looked like.
Oh yeah, with that red emergency lighting, you know, that you see in submarines. Yeah, big time, big time.
Imagine the Murker coming down that corridor. We'd barely be able to see him. Marvelous.
Which is what you needed. This is a bit pants, isn't it? This him kicking
Yeah,
the
well, it's
lever and.
wobbling a bit as well, you know.
He's
And
barely touching it.
she's definitely 11. She's like, "Well done, Pegs." Like, Jesus. Tone it down, Bonnie. Come on. Although, by all accounts, like Pip and Jay said, they never wrote a scream into the script, never once. So I think, and JNT wanted a screamer. And he wanted, like in Trial of Time, and he wanted her to scream into the key of the title music. So what's weird is we said earlier about the music, the original score that was very primitive and sort of 60s. And he said, no, that's too dated. I want something more modern. And yet, in other ways, it's a throwback to the past.
Yeah. I think that's the thing. He's a very complex character, wasn't he?
Have you read that book? He was very complex.
And very problematic in many ways, if all of that's true.
Can I ask you a question that I can only ask you, really?
Oh.
Who's the best looking Kang?
Fire Escape.
Fire Escape. Is she the one with the punk wig or the curly hair?
The punk wig,
Oh
yeah.
yeah, she's is that Mark Strickland's wife?
Yeah, at this point she was, yeah.
No.
Yeah.
In fact, there's a wonderful story about that in JNT's diaries that he did for Doctor Who magazine, where Mark Strickland put his head into JNT's office and went, "John, Julie and I were getting married, all right, but please, no publicity." And he kept his word, because he'll get publicity out of anything.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah, no, yeah. Without a shadow of a doubt, I didn't even have to think about that. Yeah. Fire Escape all day long.
Oh, so we've got the blue Kangs and the red Kangs all together now.
Yeah.
See, that's what I like is the bit where McCoy goes, how the hell are we going to unite the factions of Paradise Towers, you know?
But it comes together quite organically, though, doesn't it? That because it's almost in the pool that we've just entered now, isn't it? Where he turns up with the Kangs and he's got the blue and the reds kind of working together, and Maddie turns up and says, "We need your help," and it's funny because the Kangs are there going, "Well, we'll work with the Rezies," or was it no to do? Is it?
No to do, yeah.
Yeah, no to do. We'll work with Pecs, no to do, but we'll never ever work with the caretakers. And
Never, ever.
just as the deputy pulls the
He goes, hello. Oh, it's wonderful. Although McCoy is a bit naughty in that bit as well. She goes, did you hear a noise? Mel goes, she goes to investigate. She goes, oh, it was nothing. And then McCoy goes, ah, he comes out the curtain, doesn't he? I've got to say, given all the hype around this beautiful crystal watered pool, the one that's presented with us is a little bit substandard.
Yeah, it's nothing special, is it?
But at least they did get a pool. Oh, I love that robot so much, that yellow robot.
See, this was my one encounter with some other people that watched Doctor Who. The only time. So the school that I went to, as you can imagine, rural school, very small, and there were only. There weren't very many of us that have had hot dinners. Everyone else had packed lunches, so they kept all of us hot dinners to two or three tables. And there was this one kid in the school. He was a couple years older than me, called Stan, and he was a bit of a Jack Lalad, bit of a rebel kind of thing. So it was really cool that he was on our table, kind of thing. And I was like, oh yeah, I'm with Stan, kind of thing.
On with Stan.
But it was really surprising the lunchtime after this episode came out with the yellow crab robot attacking Mel in the pool.
Yeah.
He goes, did you watch Doctor Who last night? I go, yeah.
Oh my God,
And he goes,
Stan watches Doctor Who.
yeah, exactly. He was going, yeah, it was really cool, wasn't it? That robot was brilliant, and I was like, S wow! Where did this come from? I had no idea anyone else liked Doctor Who,
You know what's so funny is Stan is such an old man name, isn't
yeah. But that
it?
was me thinking, wow, he's so cool.
So, sorry, you was in the hot dinner club, were you, or were you in the cold
I
lunch
was in
club?
the hot dinners,
Oh
yes.
man,
So
you
like you
must have
said.
had some money then.
Oh well, we had to. I remember I had to take in like our lunch money in an envelope every Monday to pay for the dinners, and I can even remember now. I think it was like £2.50 for the week, and it's
No, oh
yeah.
Jesus Christ, that wouldn't get you a portion of chips now,
Well,
you
you wouldn't get a meal deal from
know.
Tesco's or wherever for that now, but yeah.
I Now, look, I don't know if you noticed that, but Richard Briers was in fact taken over by a sinister light at the end of that episode.
Was. He was.
And he's in gate, sort of being dragged in there, going, "Oh, I've always given you tasty little morsels, you know, what's the matter?" And then Sylvester McCoy was rather unconvincingly grabbed by the cleaner claw, or rather put his neck into it because the cleaner couldn't reach him. Is that one of the better Doctor Who cliffhangers?
Well, I mean,
Bit of a leading question there.
yeah. I mean, like, if you've come from the Colin Baker era into this, then this probably seems quite dramatic and dynamic, doesn't it? Because, bless him, all the cliffhangers were pretty much a crash zoom into Colin's face, weren't they?
Up his nose,
Yeah,
yeah.
yeah. So I think if you look at it from that point of view, it probably would be quite exciting. But yeah, it's not. It's not.
I mean, it's on paper, it's possession and an attack by robots. I just don't know if the direction that is strongest there.
No, but I mean, like that point you were saying that you know Sylvester had to put his neck into it. They've had that problem since the first since that
That is
caretaker,
true.
because
Yeah.
he almost grabs it, doesn't he, and pulls the claw over to his.
Just the camera's a bit tighter at that point, so it disguises it a bit more. He's doing this in sort of mid shot.
Yeah. I think in theory it's great. In what we actually see, not so. Yeah, I mean, like, I think cliffhangers for this story, the only one that I feel is a very good or good is that one where Mel's menaced by the two Rezzies. Because just because it's, whoa, that's shocking, you know.
I think that's the best of one of the best of the season as well. I think, you know, I don't think this is the strongest year for
Oh
any
no.
Doctor.
You know, when you've got like weird green puppets popping out of an egg that's meant to be a baby.
The thumb as the mouth, you know. Well, I'm not sure. The
And that
bubble
was
trap
screaming.
cliffhanger is great, isn't it?
I'm
Tommen
sorry.
Irani won the bubble trap
Yes.
cliffhanger.
Yeah.
That's a
Yeah.
goodie.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think if there's any others. No, see the fella that attacks them in Delta with the Elvis Presley sort of cosplay. That's not the best in the world.
Do you? Because you guys, when you did that commentary on that, you didn't mention that he's a musician, the guy that plays
Oh, is
the
he? I didn't know.
yeah. Do you remember they were an a cappella group called the Flying Pickets in the 80s? Do you remember those?
What was one of their famous songs?
Only You.
La 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 la,
Yeah,
la 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 la. Oh,
he's
that's
the main man for that.
gorgeous.
He's the
No,
main.
he's
Yeah,
not.
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, the fellow who goes, I don't just do it because I
Yeah.
do it for pleasure.
I like it. Yeah, with the
That's
Brummie accent. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
the fellow
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
from Only You. Oh, bugger me. You learn something new every day.
Yeah.
I'm gonna throw a couple more questions
Oh,
at you, if
okay.
that's all right, before we out. Dave Rennie asks, "Hello, Dave. Which Kangs are the best?"
Reds,
Yeah,
without a shadow
well,
of a doubt.
it's only because he wants to have it off with Mark Strickson's ex-wife, but
Yeah,
it is the Reds.
definitely, definitely.
Although I'll say with whoever, you know, that fabulous lady from Bad Wolf, whatever side she's on, I'll go with.
Okay.
Damian McMillan just says, "I love this episode." Well,
Quite right too.
so do we.
Yeah.
Time Lord Danny says, Mrs. Remington fan, that's David Mascal, and I would like to know who you prefer out of Tilda or Tabby if you had to pick one.
I would go with Tabby. Tabby, yeah.
Tabby!
I might need to be corrected on this as well, but I believe the actress that played Tabby was in a CBBC program called Simon and the Witch. Did you remember that?
Yes,
Yeah.
yeah.
So I for me it's like, oh, it's the witch from Simon and the Witch. So yeah, I've got enough. You kind of get attachments through that sort of childhood programming.
Also, Elizabeth Spriggs, that's the actress's name, who was originally cast as Cecchini in The Two Doctors, but Peter Moffat fired her because she wouldn't turn up for rehearsals.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so you don't learn anything on this podcast.
No. Wowzers.
And she also appeared in a truly abysmal episode of the 90s Tomorrow People, but was by far the best thing in it. She was this mad old country bumpkin, but she was very funny in that too.
See, it's not a program I've watched, the Tomorrow's People, but I hear it that production-wise, it was really, really
Do
tight.
you know the 90s one? Actually, the production values were pretty good. The early ones, I mean, I'll recommend a few. There's one with Sylvester McCoy, Peter
Oh,
Davison
Pete
in gold
Davidson.
underpants and a terrible wig. Okay, we've got a question here from, I don't know who this person is, Rod Who,
Oh,
who
never heard
asks,
of him.
do you know anyone called Rod?
No.
Me neither. If you foolishly believe, like Andrew Cartmell, that two actors are hideously miscast, namely Briers and Cook, who would you have cast instead as the chief caretaker and Pecs?
Well, I will stand by this, and I feel that Briers is a good casting in my opinion. We've talked about that. I feel that his persona as that sort of officious kind of caretaker is brilliant. I do have issue a bit with the possession. Who would you? That's a good question.
X. Was there any
Yeah.
muscle men in British acting talent at the time?
The general problem with that is that if you've got someone who's big and muscly, they tend to not be a very good actor, do they? Arnold Schwarzenegger, I'm looking at you.
Yeah, it's a good point. Oh, what about Sonny Koldenas, who played Kemal in Evil of the Daleks? He
Yeah.
was a big, muscly bloke.
Yeah. Yeah, but he then they made him have like mute parts, didn't they? He didn't do
Yeah. And
anything.
have you heard him on the documentaries? He's fucking hilarious, that man.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think who was kind of in the 80s, who was around that was reasonably muscly in the UK. I don't.
I think we could search for some time and come up
Yeah.
with absolutely nothing.
But I do agree with Rod that I don't think it because it feels like part of that part was that he was meant to be this big muscly guy who was a coward, and we ended up with this guy who is not very big, and you lose that kind of joke, I suppose, that
Like visually, you missed the point of the character, but I do think
Yeah.
Cook gives a good performance.
Oh yes. Yeah, without a shadow of a doubt. I think what he does do with the part is really, really good. And he plays that sort of cowering sort of, I suppose, because it reminds me a little bit of this is gonna sound daft, Shaggy from Scooby-Doo,
It
because
does a
he's like,
bit.
sort of shivering and shaking,
Reggie, yeah, oh my god,
We just needed a
he
big
could
round
do the
card.
voice, couldn't he? You know what, Mel? I'm sorry, that was awful. I mean, all Howard could really need to do was eat, I don't know, 1,000 chicken breasts and rice and do, 9,000 reps.
I mean, nowadays, actors do that sort of stuff, don't they?
Yeah,
They
I don't know
do.
if they were doing it for Doctor Who in
No.
1997, though. They were only getting paid about 50 quid.
And mind you, Tony Selby put on weight for his role in Doctor Who, didn't he?
I don't think that was a chore for him, though.
No.
He said he just ate a load of donuts. Well,
Exactly.
look, whilst it would be lovely to continue to talk about Tony Selby's dietary habits, maybe we should
Oh, yeah.
jump on into episode 4. What do you reckon?
Yes, we should do that. We should. Because that's what people have come to listen to, not to.
No, people love all the bump more than anything, I'll tell you.